This message comes from NPR sponsor, Hulu. Based on shocking true events, the new Hulu original series, Under the Bridge, tells the story of a savage murder in a small town. Starring Riley Keough and Lily Gladstone, Under the Bridge is now streaming with new episodes Wednesdays, only on Hulu.
Hi, I'm Zeb from Du Bois, Pennsylvania. The Sound of Young America is an independent production supported by listeners like you and me. If you'd like to donate to support the show, visit MaximumFun.org and click on Donate.
Live on tape from my house in Los Angeles, I'm Jesse Thorne, and this is The Sound of Young America from MaximumFun.org.
Radio sweetheart on the airways, it's the sound of young America. Maximum.
Before I talk to Eleni Mendel, here's Littlefoot, one of the more rocking numbers from her brand new record, Artificial Fire. It's The Sound of Young America. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest on the program is Eleni Mendel, a Los Angeles native and Los Angeles superstar, singer-songwriter, whose rich singing voice has graced many albums over the past 10 years, the most recent of which is Artificial Fire. Eleni, welcome back to The Sound of Young America. It's great to have you.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So you're a Los Angeles native, which, you know, I'm a San Francisco native, and it's one of those things that, like, people put a bumper sticker on their car or get a custom license plate frame about.
And, wait, being from here or being,
no, being
from
a, being San a San Francisco. Francisco native, and it occurs to me that it's rare for me to meet a Los Angeles native who lives in Los Angeles.
And likes it,
yeah.
Well, yet I got lost coming over here.
What was it like? Well, that's the arrogance of the native. You think you can handle it, but
true.
You can't.
It's true.
What was it like for you growing up in L.A.? What kind of neighborhood did you grow up in?
I grew up in Sherman Oaks. In the valley.
Sure.
South of the boulevard. I had a nice childhood. My parents, liberal Democrats, voluntarily bussed us over the hill. And I think L.A. contributed to my daydreaminess, my pessimistic romanticism, stuff like that.
What do you mean when you say that it contributed to your daydreaminess? What was it about it?
It's so big and empty. Well, especially growing up in the valley, we didn't have coffee houses and stuff like that when I was growing up. So being under 18 and under 21 meant you were pretty limited in what you could do, where you could go. And I was also, you know, fairly shy and a total goody two shoes. So I didn't really know what was out there. Then I discovered Melrose as the whole LA punk scene was kind of in full swing.
When did you become a musician? When did you first start playing?
I don't even know if that answered your question.
I've
played music almost my whole life. Started violin and piano when I was 5, and then quit when I was 13 and decided that I wanted to play guitar when I was 15 because I wanted to be in a band like X.
Wait, now when you let me clarify there. When you quit violin, did you decide in 2 years I'm going to start playing
the
guitar? Okay.
No, I just hated the violin and I wasn't interested in classical music. I didn't know there'd be more music in my life. But then I discovered the band X, and then I thought, well, I want to be in a band just like that. But I don't think I'm going to find anybody who's going to let me in their band unless I can play the guitar.
How did you discover X?
Actually, one of the unsavory girls I was friends with in junior high, she turned my friend and me onto them because she had an older sister who would go to their shows.
Were you, just described yourself as a goody two-shoes.
Yeah.
Were you like slumming it with bad kids?
I guess now that you mention it, that's sort of been a pattern of mine my whole life. I was always, I guess I was looking for adventure. So this girl, she was much more reckless and adventurous than I was. She was, you know, she was already doing drugs and having sex, I think, when we were 13, which at the time seemed like, wow, I'm so square. But now I'm like, my God, we were just kids.
Wait, were you not, you were actively not having sex and doing drugs?
Oh, no. I think when I was 13, one thing I definitely knew not to do drugs. That was somehow, I think it was this police officer that would go to schools with his parrot to tell you not to do drugs.
Sure. How can you say no to him?
Yeah. I don't know if it was him or it was my parents, but I had a pretty good idea I wasn't going to do drugs. And then the sex part, I think still at that time, I believed I would wait until I was married. And thank God I got that idea. No way, Jose. Not going to happen.
I don't see a ring on your left hand there.
Yes, you're right about that.
Was it a choice when you were a young teenager that you were going to hang out with kids who were more adventurous than you? Or was it something that you fell into?
I definitely fell into it. Even my best friend sort of went off in a racier kind of, what's the word I'm looking for? She had a racier life than me. I remember the first time she told me she smoked pot and I think I cried. I don't know why I cared. yeah, I was a very, very good girl.
That's a situation where a lot of times as people go through that kind of change of adolescence, if you know, your friend changes and all of a sudden, you know, wants to go to the drag races or whatever it is, you know, wants to go up to the point to play chicken, that you'll just diverge and that's the end of that. Why do you think that you stuck with these folks who were becoming bad girls without becoming a bad girl yourself?
Oh, I don't know. That's a really good question. The irony is, though, that best friend of mine who, you know, broke it to me that she had smoked pot, she's now married with three kids, living in a mansion in a wealthy suburb of Chicago. So she really ended up so much more straight and narrow than I did. I don't know what it is. I guess I wanted something. I couldn't really put my finger on it. I was completely afraid. And I would even lie, like, sure, yeah, I like drugs, which was a complete lie.
That was the best lie you could come up with, too. I like drugs.
No, this is what I said. I remember specifically in PE, there were two sort of gangster girls that were really kind of large girls. And I was immediately afraid, but thought I could get them to like me. We were in the same squad. And one was called Yogi and one was called Boo Boo. Those were their gang names. They were in La M, according to them. No, these were just, we had to like sit in the squad just for roll call. So they were in my squad and they'd be like, so do you smoke pot? And I'd be like, yeah, I have, but I'm just not, I just don't want to right now. That's how I dealt with it.
Like at this point in your life or just in gym class?
I think I meant like, yeah, in my life, like I was taking a break.
So I don't think there is any more Los Angeles institution rock band than X, a band that, you know, really typified the Los Angeles music scene in the 1980s. And also,
thank you for knowing that.
to a certain extent, as you just kind of pointed out, never quite made a huge national impact. There's sort of a real tweener type of situation, hugely important for some people, but then also, you know, never with enormous hits or anything.
Yeah.
Were you aware of their sort of localness when you first got into them?
Well, by the time I got into them, they were actually huge here. They were selling out the Universal Amphitheater. They were selling out the Palace and the Palladium. And they were, you know, the Red Hot Chili Peppers opened for them and Jane's Addiction opened for them. So I thought everybody loved them and knew them. I thought they were the coolest.
What did you think was so cool about them?
Well, I'd never heard that weird combination of so many sounds coming together. We had rockabilly, they had rockabilly guitar player, beautiful male, like really creamy, smooth male George Jonesy vocal. And then X Scene, just kind of like crazy poetry, atonal in some respects. And, you know, great drummer DJ Bonebreak. Shout out to him because he's going to be subbing for my regular drummer on my U.S. tour. Imagine that. What a dream come true.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think it was sort of like this weird light bulb went off over my head. Like, whoa, you mean music doesn't all sound like Barry Manilow? Far out. You know, it was pretty cool.
They're sort of known as a punk rock band, but as you just described, really crossed a lot of genres in their music and very self-consciously just mixed a lot of different kinds of sounds.
Yeah, another unfortunate influence on me. I want to be paid back for this.
When you fell in love with this idea of this kind of noisy, crazy rock and roll and decided to learn to play the guitar so you could be in a band, did it work?
Well, a few months into playing the guitar, I learned fairly quickly because I already had a musical background. And a few months in, I met another kid at school who was ditching PE. That's right. As good as I was, I did ditch PE for a few weeks in 10th grade. And he had a leather jacket, and we got to talking. He said he played the drums. I know, it sounds crazy, right?
He had a leather jacket, and we got to talking.
By the way, you're the only person who's ever led me to talk about PE, pot smoking, the guy that wanted to be in a band with me in high school. So, we had two band rehearsals, and we played my songs. And strangely enough, I didn't think this bass player was good enough. I mean, I had no experience whatsoever, but I was like, he's not playing lots of notes. What's going on? So that was the end of the band, unfortunately. But the cool thing was that we rehearsed in... I think it was the bass player's uncle's diner when it was closed. Isn't that weird? This is the 80s, by the way. This is not the 50s.
It sounds a lot less weird in the context of cutting gym class and talking to a guy because he's wearing a leather jacket.
Yeah.
You went to college at UC Berkeley, right?
Yeah. I don't think I was as fully conscious at the time, so I wasn't totally aware of how different it was. Now I'm so picky, but... back then, I was like, okay, I guess I'll buy a tie-dye t-shirt.
How did it affect your music to move to Berkeley, a place well known for its eclecticism, certainly?
Well, I was still the first 3.5 years of being at Berkeley, I was still trying to get some guys to invite me to be in their band, and we sometimes get together. I was kind of always writing songs, but I was never really, really playing music until the end. And by that time... In high school, I discovered Tom Waits. And then I finally dawned on me like, oh, I don't need to be invited into a band. I can do it myself. So I don't know if Berkeley had a real musical effect on me because I still kind of had my heroes and moved back to L.A. as soon as I got the chance.
Was there something that changed then that 3.5 years in? What was the difference?
I met Chucky Weiss and... you know, he was definitely another sort of unsavory character, although he's, you know, he became my mentor. He's actually a very nice man from a good family. But at the time, I was like, whoa, this doesn't seem right. Okay, I'll get in your car with you.
he was a Tom Waits collaborator.
Yeah,
cohort,
Tom Waits collaborator, also a well-known legend in Los Angeles.
How did you meet him?
We were both dining at Musso and Frank's over there on Hollywood Boulevard, and I walked by his table and he said hello. So, so cheesy. And we got to talking. That night he said, why don't you meet me at Canner's, famous LA deli. I got to meet a friend there. And that friend was Tom Waits. So it all worked out, I guess. It all led me down this path, this dark, strange path.
It's the Sound of Young America. I'm Jesse Thorne. We'll have more with Eleni Mendel, including some songs, when we return in just a minute on The Sound of Young America from MaximumFun.org.
Production of The Sound of Young America is supported in part by Ask Metafilter. Thousands of life's little questions answered. Online at ask.metafilter.com.
The Maximum Fun Drive runs May 1st through May 15th. It's your chance to support your favorite podcasts, that's our podcasts, and grab awesome thank you gifts. We have giving levels from $2 a month to $10 a month to $200 a month, and dozens of books, CDs, and DVDs hand-selected for you and ready to give away. Visit us online starting May 1st for the Maximum Fun Drive.
It's the Sound of Young America. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is Eleni Mandel. Her new album is Artificial Fire. Eleni, you want to sing a song for us?
Okay, so I'll play Personal.
Martini olives, I only drink two, number three. My hair is plain brown, once I was blonde, yellow, not to it. I like to drink coffee with one cube of sugar, always with cream and never with milk. Only dark chocolate, I really love summer. I love to be warm. To feel hopeful. Under the stars in Audrey's backyard, wanting for someone to kiss me. But someone would not, and time's getting short, the night's growing colder, and I'm going home. We danced and we danced in my old apartment. When everyone left, someone slept on the couch. I thought about love and how I love somebody else. But is that enough? Lining of memories, each one a hair. At the edge of the mirror, I count and I stare. I wish that the quiet would end with a telephone ring. Could a friend turn into a different thing? Laughing and laughing in my old apartment, but that's not what lovers do. They sigh and hope for the future.
Eleni Mandel performing Personal from her new album, Artificial Fire. That's a song that as I was listening to it on the record, I was wondering if it has a Personal as kind of a cheeky name to give a song. It sounds almost like the kind of song that someone would write out of like a challenge from someone, like you've been writing too many external songs lately.
Oh, yeah. No one would ever say that about me. Sometimes I'm not very good at titling songs, and I didn't know what else to title it because it was all such personal information. And then I think when I started writing it, I thought it could be sort of a list like you have in a personal ad. And then it sort of veered off in a different direction.
Do your songs often surprise you when you're writing them?
Yeah, I love that part. I love it. And sometimes you don't even realize the surprise for a long time. And you're like, oh, I was psychic. Was never going to work out.
Is there an example you can think of?
There's a song, I think it's on my second record. I'm pretty sure. It's called Moment That You Had. And it's a really, really short song. I actually like it quite a lot. And it's talking in the past tense about a man. And I remember my boyfriend at the time said, that's about me. And I'm like, no, it isn't. What do you mean? You don't do this, you know? And of course, it completely was about him. And also talking about how it was just a moment and it wasn't going to work out, basically. So that's an example.
You say you moved right back to L.A. after college. Have you always felt like LA was the place for you, or did you ever have doubts?
I was pretty sure I didn't fit into the Bay Area mold. Didn't get into the Patagonia so much. Sorry, you're from the Bay Area. You're not into that. Well, that's more of the East Bay.
Yeah, sure.
Than San Francisco.
Well, UC Berkeley, certainly.
Yeah. I think it was really the LA music scene that I'd met Chuck. He encouraged me to play music. And that's when I was like, oh my God, that's it. That's what I'm going to do. And then I felt like I had to come back to LA for that. Then I spent a long time hating LA and looking around the country for other places to live.
What did you hate about it?
I just didn't fit in. I wasn't cool enough and I couldn't find a boyfriend and, you know, a lot of poor me stuff. I just felt like I wasn't tough enough I didn't find my niche. And then I moved to the east side of town and then I sort of found my way a little bit more.
What was different? What's different for folks who don't live in LA? what's the difference?
We're a divided city. Well, I was living really like the heart of Hollywood / West Hollywood, La Brea and Beverly area. And I guess that's pretty actory around there.
That's sort of the Hollywood that people think of if they think of Hollywood.
Yeah. So I was a waitress and waiting on a lot of jerky, you know, film industry people. Felt that way at the time. One famous film industry person tipped me very, very poorly, but I probably shouldn't say who it is.
No, you probably should. You probably should.
Really? Can I say it?
Yeah, absolutely. Of course.
Quentin Tarantino.
Oh, Tarantino.
I'll never forget. The bill was like $18.37 and he left a 20. As a waitress, you never forget the bad tippers. So famous people should actually be careful about that. So I lived there. And then to the west is Santa Monica, Westwood. I definitely don't fit in over there. That's a little more East Bay vibe. And then to the east is Los Feliz, Silver Lake, Echo Park, downtown. And that's kind of the area that I've found that I could live happily, sort of happily. Still complained quite a bit. And, you know, I entertained moving to Athens, Georgia, and New York, and Portland. And then I realized, actually, Los Angeles is paradise. And everybody's going to want to live here.
You described earlier a little bit the way that you think being at Angeleno has affected your music. And there's this sense of the vast space of Los Angeles and the way that it affects your sort of day-to-day life and your personal interactions and your connections with people and stuff like that. Tell me how you think that's been reflected in your music.
That's a good question. I guess I became really attracted to the noirish side of Los Angeles and finding sort of beautiful moments in surprising places and, you know, beauty and ugliness and really, you know, got sucked into sort of this, I mean, if I say like the dark underbelly of Los Angeles, that would be a little bit of a stretch, but I did have sort of a phase where I was hanging out with some really unsavory types.
How unsavory?
You know, they did drugs, you know, heavier drugs than than the pot of my eighth grade best friend. You know, drinking and driving. No fights or crimes or anything. I think there was some shoplifting of like Easter candy once. I think I was looking in that direction for something to write about, although I wasn't aware of it at the time. That I became attracted to this because I became so immersed in Tom Waits's music and that world, and I was like, okay, where do I find my underbelly world?
Do you feel like you found it, or even if you did find it, do you feel like it was like an honest expression of you or a looking for something else outside yourself?
I think both, really, because I definitely honestly wanted something different than I knew. But I remember actually a boyfriend back in the early 90s accusing me of dating him only to have something to write about. I hope that's true, because if I actually liked the guy, that would be really, really, really pathetic.
Well, speaking of things to write about, you want to sing another song for us?
Okay. My songs have gotten a little cheerier, I think. And just to not mislead your listeners, the record doesn't sound like this at all. It's much more exciting. This is called Right Side.
My baby dreams while he's awake. He slips down city streets. His soles are worn so that he skates while he's walking. My baby laughs while he's asleep. Too hot to worry, he kicks the covers with his feet while he's laughing. Turquoise like a swimming pool, but calm and gray like morning. I've got the right side. I've got the right side. I've got the right side. Touch a heart that's beating. Violet falls across the land. The sun's gone down, it's evening. I've got the right side. I've got the right side.
Elaine Mandel performing Right Side from her new album called Artificial Fire. This album is different from your last couple. You just described it as a bit more exciting. It's a bit less of a Smokey Chanteuse album and a bit more of a rock and roll album. Did you decide to make something with a little bit more guitar solo action?
Yeah, partly it was probably meeting Jeremy Drake, my guitar player, and being really inspired by the way he played and the really different kind of sounds he came up with, and also really consciously wanting to have more fun, wanting to play electric guitar, wanting to dance a little bit, maybe make other people dance.
I've read you talking about hosting secret dance parties in your living room.
Yeah, and it doesn't take a lot of people for me to have a dance party. Anywhere from 2 to, 50. But yeah, I love to dance. So I was having a lot of dance parties, which I think heavily influenced this record. That's not to say it's really, in a way it's misleading, I told somebody I really wanted to rock out, and they're like, it's not exactly like a metal record. So I think it's still very much me, but I do feel like I'm getting a little bit of backlash.
Really?
Yeah. It's my blonde on blonde, I guess. I've gone electric.
Do you want to sing one more song for us?
All right. What should I do?
I don't know.
Should
it's
I try
choice.
To rock out now? I'll do a not so rock version of Artificial Fire.
Found the treasure at last. We have to count backwards. We start at the end till we find what we're after. There are two kinds of men. He could never be true, but am I just like him? Am I unfaithful too? I was drawing a map, but I couldn't have known. Take a right, take a left. You'll know when you get there. The puzzle will fit late one night, Montreal, with his clothes on the floor and his artificial fire. Is there anybody counting this mathematical equation? Could there be another answer? Could I change his mind, or could he change mine? Why can't there be one? He tried to explain in the dark. I would laugh, we were talking and naked, reading my map late one night, Montreal. Found the treasure at last, it was artificial fire. Is there anybody counting this mathematical equation? Could there be another answer? Could he change my mind, or could I change his mind? It was new, it was old from the start, it was both. And a year nearly passed in one night, Montreal. I'm a killer at heart, and I wanted to feel, so I laid out my trap with my artificial fire.
Eleni Mandel performing the title song from her brand new record, Artificial Fire. Eleni, thank you so much for taking the time to be on the Sound of Young America. It was great to have you.
It was so fun. Thanks for dragging all that personal information out of me.
That's our time for another Sound of Young America program. I've been your host, Jesse Thorne, America's radio sweetheart. The show produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our theme music written and performed by Dan Grayson with help from myself. Interstitial music provided by Dan Wally. Our intern is Brian Fernandez. The editor on this episode, Nick White. If you have thoughts about the show, you can email me at jesse@MaximumFun.org. And don't forget that the Maximum Fun Drive is coming up May 1st through 15th of 2009. We'll see you next time right here on The Sound of Young America.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Rosetta Stone, an expert in language learning for 30 years. Right now, NPR listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership to 25 different languages for 50% off. Learn more at rosettastone.com/NPR.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Progressive Insurance, where drivers who switch could save hundreds on car insurance. Get your quote at progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates.
Taylor Swift has dropped a new album. She is the biggest pop star in the world, and everything she does makes news.
I gasped. I was like, oh my God, I've been there, and you can identify with it.
For a breakdown of Taylor Swift and her new album, The Tortured Poets Department, listen to the Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast from NPR.